Everybody, good to see you all. Happy again. Let's continue with this Book of Rinpoche's, learning how to live and die, so we can carry on living in the next life in a way that we choose. Remember that. This is quite shocking to us. We're the boss. Keep saying it. We're the boss. Okay, so we're gonna just think. Don't put the prayers up. Just think, okay? Do it in our own minds. Think. This is the meaning of the prayers. So think. We're going to, you know, until we're enlightened, we're going to rely upon the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. Well, that's for those of us who already identify with being Buddhist. Maybe we haven't defied it, so that's in which case you don't say it, don't think it. But, you know, and then the second lines are stating our purpose for being together, our motivation, as the lamas say. We, by listening to these teachings, thinking about it, analyzing, contemplating, internalizing these views so that we can turn them into practice, may we become a Buddha. May it be the cause for us to be actually enlightened in the future so we can really then be of benefit to others. That's the plan. Think like that. Sangye charang soke chognam la jancho baru dagni kyab suchi dagi chernyen gipe sonam ki drola penche sangye drupa shok sangye charang soke chognam la jancho baru dagni kyab suchi dagi chernyen gipe sonam ki drola penche sangye drupa shok. That's three times. That's it. Let's go. Okay. So we're using Lama Zopa Rinpoche's book, formerly known as How to Enjoy Life, also formerly known, another version of it that was a PDF, How to Help Your Loved Ones Enjoy Life so they can go happily to their future rebirth, which is the real point of the book. But then it's now called From Wisdom, the paperback, and there's a digital version as well, and hopefully it's going to get going on the audiobook. How to Face Death Without Fear, which is a, you know, pretty basic one. So the first part of the book is like I said, is sort of background, you know, nuts and bolts of things. The one section is all what happens, what is death? And this is where the Vajrayana comes in. The Vajrayana is amazing. The technical details in the Vajrayana are quite fascinating, you know. And as we know, the Tibetan Buddhist system is within the framework of the Vajrayana. The system that existed, that has been carrying on from India since about the, you know, the great Mahasiddhas, all the great yogis in India, into the land of tradition, then straight into Tibet, unbroken, going right back to Buddha. So the death process, as we described, so there's two ways, as we've been talking, there are two ways to, you know, prepare for death. One is live your life properly. I mean, if you do this, death will be fine. But you can be more technical about it. You can be more technical about it, learn all these different, like the meditation you did yesterday, learn the system in the Vajrayana, especially having taken an empowerment, so that you can really, really seriously learn, train to go through the process, because it's something that happens every time we sleep. It's not something esoteric. I mean, it's esoteric to us in neuroscience, my goodness, yes. But it's the same process as sleep, which is a miracle. It's amazing. So we can practice using sleep, you know. The same deconstruction of those 25 components described in terms of eight stages occurs exactly the same way when you sleep, which is equivalent to dying, except obviously death is more dramatic. And then you wake up into a dream, don't you? That's your subtle mind. That's like the intermediate state. And then you wake up back into life. Well, the difference with death is you wake up in another body, you know. But the system is the same. The technology is the same. As I mean, as she says, Tantra is highly technical, you know. So the way to live our lives is in the framework of the fact that we're impermanent. This is a teacher's point from the first level of the Lam Rim, you know, to really understand that everything is impermanent. But particularly he gets us to, you know, right between the eyeballs, getting us to realize the impermanence of death. Whose death? Our death. And like as I was talking, let's remind ourselves, we know about death. It's staring us in our face every day. All the ants, the creatures, the rats, the humans, every day. We can see it bluntly, but we don't get the learning. And this is the simple point. This is a simple point. We don't get the learning. What's the learning? As soon as you say, that'll happen to me, it's the wake-up call. Until you say that, even when your beloveds die, even when the worst deaths in the universe for you, your beloveds, your poodle, your husband, your children, still you don't get the learning. You get grief, you have compassion, but you don't get the point, and the point is so simple. That'll happen to me. All you got to do is say that, and that's the point. You got it. Boom. Then you'll start to understand. It's not complicated. We miss that piece. We miss that piece. That'll happen to me. That'll be me, you know. I mean, we only get that when we're told we're going to die soon. Anybody, any of you maybe have been told you're going to die. You've got a disease, right? And you're going to be dying. You've been given a date, roughly, approximately, like my friends on death row. Then we start to think about the meaning of life. You know? Then we start to think about what the hell is the point? And this is the point that the teacher's making in his very first point, the three points: death is definite, time of death is uncertain, and then the third point, the action point, what is important at the time of death? And that's the thinking we have to do. Let's remind ourselves of this. It's quite precise, you know. If we take the Buddha's view, which of course is we're discussing here, given that our consciousness goes back and back, second, first, second, and then given that every millisecond of what we think and do and say, this law of karma programs our mind, sows seeds in our mind, which determine our future. We are our own creators. Such a shocking concept. And then given our mind continues in the future, programmed with our thoughts, our actions and our thoughts. And given, of course, the next level of detail is the so-called negative actions ripen as suffering and positive ones ripen as happiness. So given logically, hey, I want happiness. Even if we take the first level of suffering, first level of suffering is suffering of suffering. Everybody agrees with that one. It's when it's when the bad things happen. Do you want, even forget about lower realms. Forget about other realms if that's even too hard for our mind. But we know we don't want the suffering. It's called the experiences similar to the cause, which is how we're seen and treated by others. We can see in our life we're all very social beings. We connect with each other. We do and say things in relation to each other. So, we're going to meet each other again and play out all the nonsense we've created, including the good stuff. It's so clear. So we know we don't like being badmouthed, harmed, lied to, stolen from, abused, raped, terrorized. We don't want to be poor, sick, living in the desert. We know we don't want that. So we can take that experience and at least take on board this view that I create these experiences and therefore I create my happy experiences. This is what's powerful. And this is a starting point. Of course, it's hard for us. Who's clairvoyant? None of us, We can't see the truth of this. So we've got to take it as a hypothesis until we can see the truth of it, which we can when we get clairvoyance, when we get single point of concentration. Go to the mountains, work really hard, a couple of years, you'll get clairvoyance and you'll prove it. Takes time, of course. So given at this level, this is the bare minimum, at least we know we don't want future suffering. So then we think, well, at the time of death, literally, what can I bring with me, basically, We know, Buddha's view is you only take your mind with you. Your mind can carry on. All the packaging, all the body is gone. It's just deconstructed. All this process of death, it's all gone. The physical's gone. The body is gone. The one where we think is me, it's gone like a dream, dissolved. All our experience is gone. Husband gone for us, effectively. House. In other words, all the things and even if we're nice people, think about this, even if we're nice, good people, still what preoccupies us in our lives? We're human, we're natural, we've got attachment, it's normal. We have families and houses and possessions and children and jobs and responsibilities. Of course they loom large in our lives, so they're the ones we think about every day. Of course they are. And so naturally we have attachment for them. So naturally we don't want to let them go. It's very painful. But they're not much use to us at the time of death. It's such a dumb analogy. I always tell this story. It sounds sort of silly, but it's a good analogy. And when I was living in California, when I was based in California, and it's the Northern California with all these redwoods, these enormous trees, For me, they're okay. They're gorgeous. They're lovely. They're wonderful. But when I lived at Land of Medicine Buddha, all these redwoods, and in the winter, it's drippy and wet. And you look up, all you can see is the bloody redwoods. You can't see the sky, and I like the sky. So I drive 2 miles down to Capitola. There's a little beach there. And I sit in the cafe and look at the sky. That was not what I liked. Trees are wonderful. I sound like I'm cynical when it comes to nature. I always joke and I say, I'm happy that I'm happy that the trees and flowers and the wild is out there. I'm happy it's there. I just don't need to see it, So anyway, these trees, and it was wet and drippy, and I know I had this period occasionally I'd take off and I'd call it my editing retreat. So I had about 9 weeks spare. So I organized with a friend who runs a center in San Jose, Puerto Rico. Okay, San Juan, little island, about 4 million people, gorgeous. The United States bought, they bought it whenever they bought it because it's strategic, right, in that big piece of the ocean there, Anyway, it's gorgeous. And they talk about how the Puerto Ricans are the happiest people on the earth. They were very happy people, it's true. Anyway, I managed to get, my friend helped me get a little on the southern island, the southern part of the island, it's very small, this resort. Got it cheap or something, and I had a place for 9 weeks in this lovely resort, 1 minute from the water. You could hear the beach, hear the sea. Pink, nice pink resort. And it was heaven. It was divine. I love the sea and I love the sun. So I was 9 weeks. I had an editing retreat to do this, beginning the work on Geshe Lama Kontog's biography. And it was heaven. So this is the analogy, okay, of like I had 9 weeks. So this is the point about impermanence. When you know that you're impermanent, then you actually, you don't think, oh, well, what's the point of enjoying something? It's not going to last forever. Oh, I thought I'd turn my phone off. Never mind. In fact, you enjoy it all the more. You use it all the more. This is the point about impermanence. When you know you're going to die soon, you don't want to waste your life. You don't want to waste, you have a sense of urgency, and that's what our teacher's trying to get us to do. So that's what I had there, was a sense of urgency, this gorgeous environment, the analogy for my life. And I'd go out there swimming every day, and I'd go walking every day, and I'd go here and go there in the restaurants because I didn't want to waste my time. So my point is, imagine I forgot it was impermanent. This is the point. Imagine I forgot this lovely scenario was impermanent. Well, what would I do? I'd become lazy. I'd wake up in the morning. Oh, I don't feel like eating today. I don't feel like sleeping. I'll do it tomorrow. I'll go to the beach tomorrow because you think it's permanent. You think it's going to last forever. So that's when we become lazy. Then I get caught up in attachment. This is my apartment, my possessions and my thing. Then I get upset with the guys next door playing rock and roll music and I'd sue them. But when you know it's impermanent, when you know I had 9 weeks, you make the most of it. You accept the rubbish. There's no point in holding on because you make the most of it. That's the point. So I always joke and imagine I'd forgotten it was impermanent. And then Rita, remember the Rita, the landlady, who'd given me the keys, and she comes along after 9 weeks, and I've completely forgotten that I now think it's my apartment and my this, and I'm angry and resentful and depressed, which is what happens when you think things are permanent. Look at our lives. And she's dragging me out, you know, screaming. And I don't know what to do because I haven't organized, go somewhere else. So this is the thing about preparing for death and preparing for the next life. I know it sounds so silly. Like I said about preparing to go recently. It's logical when you know you're in charge. You don't wait. I was sitting there weeping on the doorstep, being thrown out of my house with no air ticket, no bags packed, nowhere to go. Well, that's how we die normally. Freak it out, holding on to the thing we've just left. Because that's the thing that looms in our lives. That's what's important. Our husband, our life, our this, our that. So, of course, the first answer to this is best to give up sex, drugs and rock and roll, leave your husband, go off, become a monk or nun and go to the mountains and get some realizations quickly. That's the best way. That's the first level. But if you're skillful, the Mahayana approach, the Bodhisattva approach is you can get the best of both worlds. If you've got some level of renunciation, you can have your husband and you can have your cake and eat it too. You can have your husband and eat him too, whatever the words are. How to use that analogy. Get the point. And you put bodhicitta into the mix. The first one is giving up attachment, you know, no time to waste. End up becoming like Geshe Lama Kontog, who meditated 24 hours a day. He didn't eat, didn't sleep, didn't need clothing, living in 6 foot of snow in the winter. That's the best. But clearly we're not that level. So then you use the Mahayana path and you have your hubby and you have your money and you have your kids, but you remember it's impermanent. You don't cling, but you make it the grist for your mill. You make that your practice. So you practice patience and humility and kindness and generosity and forgiveness and give up attachment and anger. Then your life becomes your practice. That's the Mahayana approach. And that's the skillful one. So don't sit there hankering, oh, I should become a nun, maybe go off to the mountains. No, deal with what you've got this second. That's your life. And you make that Dharma. Like the house in Puerto Rico. Just an analogy. You know it's not yours. You know it's just a house that you're living in temporarily and you enjoy it while you've got it, but you're happy to say goodbye. And what do you do before you say goodbye to that little apartment in Puerto Rico? I had to buy my air ticket to get to freezing old Boston. I remember Puerto Rico was like 70 point something degrees. It was 80 degrees Fahrenheit. It was delicious. Lovely. The beach every day was heaven. Just the analogy. But I didn't think I had to leave. There was no point in clinging. So I enjoyed what I had. You made the most of it. And then I was prepared when Rita, you know, I had my bag packed and I took a flight and I went to Boston. So you prepare your future. We do this. We live our lives like this. We just don't think of the next life. It's just too weird for us. We're not used to thinking that way, you know. That's the way to think. And then you'll say goodbye with a happy mind. See you, darling. See you next life. Goodbye. No attachment. So you make the most, you get the best of your life. And in this way, you see it in the framework of impermanence. You see your life and your husband and your children in the framework of impermanence. So you make it your practice every second, as much as you can. And then your mind is happy, you're kind to others, and you're putting marvelous imprints in your mind and you're preparing for your next life. This is how to live your life. It's just how you have to learn to think like this. We have to learn to reframe our philosophy in our head, you know. Then death will not be a problem. You'll be able to leave easily. Pack your bag, ready to go. And as Rinpoche says, the ones who die with a happy mind, they, death is a blissful experience because their mind's virtuous and therefore content, not afraid. So you live your life. Then when death comes, and then add on to that, if you're a Buddhist, Tibetan Buddhist, you're taking your highest yoga tantra empowerment, then you do this practice as of, you know, doing through the eight stages. And if you haven't even had an empowerment, it's okay. You can still practice the eight stages. You can still do that. But it's all these sadhanas are constructed in such a way that you incorporate this eight stages and you can transform the death into the Dharmakaya, the intermediate state into the Sambhogakaya, and rebirth into the Nimanakaya. The three levels, you know. And then death, as Rinpoche says, death is a blissful experience. You're using it skillfully. So in other words, you've got to totally reframe the way we think about death. So naturally, if we're materialists, which is the world we live in, then death is a horrifying idea. It's a horrifying, of course it's horrifying, because you turn into nothing. I mean, anyway, of course you'd be scared if you turn into nothing. I agree with you. So that's to live our lives like this. And then you don't even want to put positive imprints into your mind. You wouldn't want to put negative imprints into your mind because you know your mind is the only thing you can bring with you. It's the only thing that carries on, you know. So we talked about that. And then we looked at the different scenarios. We looked about the background. We talked about the 12 links. We talked about, well, actually, now let me read you from Lama Zopa's book about the 12 links. There's a little chapter on that. We've mentioned it in relation to the death process. Now we'll just mention, we'll read Rinpoche's words about it, just to put the imprint of his words into your mind. I have to find it every time. I forget it. Here we go. Okay. So it's part two, how we go from one life to the next. So what happens at death? The 12 links of dependent arising at the time of death. Well, that's what we'll talk about. So the 12 links is Lord Buddha's a sutra, you know, is a teaching he gave about how we create second by second. We create lifetime, rebirths. We sort of, this is kind of cycle, how we create this, you do this, then do this because of this, and therefore this, and therefore that, and therefore this, and therefore that. Like that. But he's talking here. Okay. The 12 links are dependent arising at the time of death. So cyclic existence operates through the 12 links of dependent arising. One, there's ignorance. Because we have this root delusion, because we have the root delusion, the root misconception, this primordial clinging to a concrete, separate, solid, inherent, intrinsic me and everything else. This is the ground. And then because of that, then, you know, we create karma, number two link, a karmic, you know, intention, and then a seed is put in the mind. And that three, the imprint of that is left on the consciousness, number three. Then number four, they call it name and form. It refers to the development now of the four mental parts of us, and then form to the physical, the egg and the sperm, when these five come together in the womb, and then they begin to develop as the fetus. They are known as the sixth sense bases. You start to grow in the fetus as a person. And then because of the senses in daily life, every second now, you have, there's one called contact, which is actually a state of mind. It's because, you know, when the consciousness connects with the external objects through the senses. And then on the basis of that, there's a feeling, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And then on the basis of that, you have attachment, craving, and then a more intense one, grasping. And then because of that, the thing comes into being, and then birth, and then finally old age and death. So Rinpoche talks, this is every second of the day, we're doing, all these are happening naturally, we're creating the causes for these types of, for this type, for a rebirth. There are billions of seeds in our mind that if we didn't purify, if we didn't create any more and just had to play out the ones that are there, you'd never end. We've got countless ones. We've got to get ahead of the game and put atomic bombs under them and stop them, you know. So now the 12 links of this perfect human rebirth. Let us discuss the 12 links in relation to this human body that we have now. What caused our consciousness to join the egg and sperm in our mother's body? So in past lives, because of ignorance, the first one, we created the, both non-virtuous and virtuous karma, the second one, which planted seeds in the mind, in our mind, which is the third one. At the time of death of our life before this one, whether we were a human or an elephant or a kangaroo, craving arose. And that's the eighth one. And that happens, as I said, about the time you start the eight stages, which is in Tantra, when you start to stop, when you start, you know, going through the process of the senses ceasing. By about the second or third one, this is when this happens. Craving arose, craving to not separate from the body, intense attachment to not, to hold on to this. Then the fear, then fear arises because of the attachment to not wanting to leave the body. That's what causes fear at the time of death. So then nine, grasping, a stronger form of attachment. This time, in our case, this is what's interesting. In our case, attachment to the future human body. Attachment to the idea of a human body. So now in the case of someone who's going to be reborn in the hell realms, the craving is the same, not wanting to separate from the body. But the grasping is to heat because they feel very cold. Many times dying people say they feel cold and beg for blankets. And that's because the heat in the body is leaving, right? But even if you give them two or three, it won't be enough. Their grasping to heat is so strong. This could also happen because of the fire element dissolving at that point. So the grasping at heat activates a negative karmic seed. The grasping is the trigger, remember, that's the one that's like the password for your ATM card. It causes the money to come out. Or the pressing the button, the grasping. And that's going to happen. Even if you're even a nice person, the grasping's still going to come. But if you've got a friend navigating you through this process and hearing your Lama's name, saying prayers, this will keep you steady. So the grasping is the very close condition. Is the trigger for the karmic seed. So, okay. All right. So grasping. So in our case, as humans now, the very close condition at the time of our past death, just before the gross consciousness ceased, which is number four, was the grasping at the wish to receive a human body. In other words, in order to receive this perfect human rebirth that we have now, we must have had not only the karma of perfect morality, that's the cause of getting it, not only the generosity, which creates the cause for us to have a good life with things in it and access to things, but also the strong desire, it's a delusion, okay? Grasping the ninth link to have a human body. So but the point is, this is how we can use it. This is the point about being useful. Well, in other words, whereas craving and grasping certainly operate in our daily life in the form of attachment, in the context of the 12 links, they are more to do with the connection of one life to the next. The karmic seed that gives rise to the new rebirth is there on our mind, the second link, but it is grasping, the ninth, at the time of death that activate its ripening. So this is a delusion, but this is where you add virtue to it and you want the human birth out of so because you want to practice and be of benefit to others, then it's using your attachment to get the human body so you can use it to be of benefit to others. Just grasping at a human body, which is what happens, and then you look at all the people on the planet who are human, but have no interest in working on their minds, no interest whatsoever. Don't even know about the mind. I'm not talking about being Buddhist. I'm talking about being just having awareness, noticing their mind plays a role in their lives. They just play out whatever they created, and then you die again. And 99% of the time they go to the lower realms because they just tip their life down the toilet by continuing attachment, continuing anger, continuing jealousy, continuing harming others. This is the tragic waste of a human life. The more we understand this process of karma, how we create it, what attachment is, what the suffering is, it's logical when we hear that the vast majority of humans born now will go to the lower realms when they die. It's not being punitive. There's no one's doing it to them. This is the tragedy. This is the reason for. This is the main reason to have compassion for beings, because we're ignorant. We don't realize we create our own reality. We've got the human body. But we don't know how to use it, you know. This is a terrible tragedy. So to summarize, five of the links are causes from past lives. Three are delusions, the link of ignorance, number one, craving and grasping, eight and nine. And two are karmas, the links of compounded action, number two, karma, and then the tenth one called becoming. It all comes together and then the life manifests. First, there are the delusion, there was the delusion, ignorance, the first link. Then the delusions arising at the time of death, the eighth, craving and ninth, and the ninth, grasping. Then there were the two karmas, the second one, in our case, a virtuous karma, which could have been created thousands, even millions of lives ago. And the second karma becoming the tenth link, the previously created karmic seed made ready by craving and grasping at death. That is what's called becoming. It's the tenth one. It is these five that formed these aggregates, this body and mind, this samsara. Of the seven results that manifest in this life, the 11th link, birth, this is different from how we think, started at the moment our consciousness joined the fertilized egg. At that second, a conception. Old age, this is hilarious now, that's birth. The first second of conception is birth. Old age, which is the next one, the beginning of the 12th, old age and death, started the very next moment. So it's downhill from there. From the second moment after conception, it's now downhill. You're heading towards death. This is very hilarious. So sometimes when I'm being cynical, I've got to refrain. When I see a brand new baby, I can kind of refrain from already it's heading to death, you know. Of course, we think the exact opposite. So now all there is left is death. Very interesting. So no delusions and karma, there's no rebirth. So from this evolution, we can understand, basically that's what the 12 links is this personal evolution. And so by understanding the 12 links, you know how to reverse the process. And so that's why the first one is ignorance. If you realize emptiness, you cut ignorance. So you cut the whole damn thing. You just cut it right there. You nip it in the bud. Because realizing emptiness is what cuts the whole process. Of course, we've got lots of other work first. That's why the Lam Rim is structured in such a way. We first control our body and speech and put atomic bombs under the habits. Then we go to the second scope and we learn about our mind. We start to get rid of the attachment and the branch delusions. Then we add bodhicitta. And then we go to the six perfections and we finally realize emptiness. We're programmed. The Lam Rim is progressively presenting all the stages. If we can get straight to emptiness, go for it, baby. You know, cut the whole lot, you know. So from this evolution, we can understand that if we had freed ourselves of delusions and karma in the past, there is no way we could have come into existence. There'd be no reason at all to have taken this human body, to have to experience the suffering of rebirth, the suffering of sickness, the suffering of old age, the suffering of death, not to mention all the other problems that we experience in daily life, not included in these four. These delusions and karma formed, put together these aggregates, this body and mind. And because we didn't cease delusions and karma in our past life by following the path, this self, this person, is still caught up in samsara. How many more sessions have we got, Steph? Today and then tomorrow, right, also?
Yeah, sorry, I was just unmuting myself for a minute. Yeah, we've got the session after today. Another one today, and then two more tomorrow, same time.
Good, I want to talk about emptiness. We need to talk about emptiness.
Yeah.
Okay. Good. So not to mention all the other, these delusions and karma formed, put together these aggregates, this body and mind. And because we didn't cease delusions and karma in our past life by following the path, this self, this person, which conventionally it does exist, is still caught up in samsara. Samsara refers either to being caught up in your delusions in your own mind or the broader one being caught up in this process of the 12 links, you know. Wherever our consciousness goes, this self goes with it. We are a self. We're a person. Maybe we talk about emptiness now. It seems logical. Let's see what happens. We're still, you know, this self goes with it because consciousness is the main base for the existence of self. The gross body exists for a short time and then disintegrates. So as long as this self is bound by delusions and karma, there is no choice. We will be burdened by these aggregates. Delusions and karma have bound this self to samsara. Now, no matter how much we do not want this suffering, as long as we are caught up in samsara, there is no freedom. So let's talk about emptiness. I think it's a good time to do that. Okay. So, you know, this self, when we hear Buddha say there's no self, and we hear Lama Zopa say there's a self, and the self goes from life to life, we're very confused, you know. So what do you mean by that? Well, basically, you know, you know, when we, the best way is, we've always, best, always the best way to talk about emptiness, and this is what I like to do best, because it, you know, Tsongkhapa praises it, and Buddha praises it, and Lama Zopa praises it, is to see the reality in the framework of the two truths. And this is what this is helping us understand here. So basically, you know, everything, things, you have to first establish what exists conventionally. So you establish a computer, a person, you know, a couch, a shoe, a statue, a flower, a computer, an iPad. Billions and trillions of things exist, don't they? And we can see that every day we are creating more phenomena. We create phenomena. I always joke and say that since Steve Jobs, we probably doubled the number of phenomena on the, in the universe. All these apps that have come up because these brilliant news. I mean, and you can prove it. This proves that minds create things. This proves it. It really proves we create things. Who'd heard of an app until Steve Jobs and some clever person started jumping in the bandwagon, and then we shortened application to the word app. And now there's billions of apps every day, new apps every day, you know. We create all of this. It's so clear we are the creators. And we forget. This is the interesting point. We forget that we did it. So basically, trillions of things exist. But the Buddha's saying we get them wrong. We, as Lama Zopa says so beautifully, that all the delusions in the mind, the branch delusions are attachment and anger and jealousy, and the root delusion, ego grasping, known colloquially as ego grasping, ignorance. What they do is, and this is the key function, they decorate on top of what is there, layer upon layer upon layer of things, of characteristics that just don't exist there. So it's evident, it's clear, attachment. When you've got attachment for the chocolate cake, on that chocolate cake on the plate, there is a chocolate cake there. You establish that. That's called chocolate cake. It's not a carrot cake. It's a chocolate cake. And it could even be a good chocolate cake. It might have won the blue ribbon in the women's show, you know. In Australia, we still call it the Royal Melbourne Show, the Royal Sydney Show, you know, whatever you call them in England and in Scotland and the UK. So it is that conventionally. There is a cake conventionally. This is the point. There is a cake conventionally. But attachment, for example, over-exaggerates its deliciousness. So attachment decorates deliciousness onto that cake that doesn't exist in the cake. And the main delusion, ignorance, decorates the ontological status of the thing itself onto it. The delusions put qualities onto the object that aren't there. It's the simplest way to put it. The simplest way to put it. So what we're trying to do this whole path, first control the berserk servants of the delusions, then get to the branch delusions, start seeing how they're liars. And now when we eventually get to the six perfections, we'll get to emptiness, we're going to attack the root delusion and discover that what these delusions think exist, don't exist. It's very simple. It's not simple, but that's the point. So we first establish, before we have to, you know, we can establish there is an iPad, a cake, a computer, or a person. We're an example of that type of phenomenon. We're called a person, or we're called a self, or we're called an I. They're all synonyms. It's for, you know, a being. A Buddha is a person. A dog is a person. A cat is a person. A hell being is a person. That's the type of phenomenon we are, you know. That's the name of the phenomenon we are. We're one of those. So we have to first establish that conventionally. And then now what we have to do is even look into how it exists conventionally, because we might know it's a cake, but we get it wrong because our delusions decorate things on top of it that don't exist there. And this is the job. This is the job we have to unpack and unravel the nonsense in our mind and start to see how we're projecting rubbish onto the outside world. And then believing it, then believing it, then believing it. That's the killer. As Lama Zopa says, bad enough that your attachment makes the cake look more delicious than it really is. Bad enough that happens. But the thing is, the killer, this is my word, the killer is we believe it is true. That's the part that keeps us paralyzed in samsara, because the habit is so strong. We believe in our own nonsense stories. We believe them. And what we're trying to do is first establish what the nonsense story is and then stop believing it. That's why this is a very powerful practice every day. You know, when you have all these delusions about ourself, I'm no good, I'm too fat, I'm no this, I'm that, I'm something else. All these unhappy stories we always have about ourself. We have them. They're very deeply ingrained. We run to them immediately like a groove in the mind. The water just goes there. That these delusions just go there because we practice them so strongly. But that's why we have to have consciousness and awareness and catch them. And this is the part that's so outrageous. we never question, do we? You look in the mirror, or you just, or you know, you just think of yourself, and you do something bad. You feel, I'm bad. I did the wrong thing. I'm bad. I did that. I'm bad. And we paint the whole of me with that one brush. We exaggerate. We never stop and say, I wonder if that's true. We never question it. This is what's so shocking. And this is the point. 27 people can say, no, you're not as bad as you think. 100 people can tell you that. On the one hand, you're hungry to hear it because you're dying for praise, but we don't believe it. This is what's hilarious. And then look what happens when one person agrees with you. You are bad, Rabina. I agree with you. You have a mental breakdown. And then you blame them. This is how ridiculous we are. So bad enough that we believe the rubbish story, the killer, the bad enough that we think the killer's the bad story, the killer is we believe it. And that is a major practice every day. Stop and question. Look in the mirror. Oh, God, I'm so fat and ugly. No, you're not ugly. It's not true. It's just your projection. It's your anger, your aversion. You've got your aversion glasses on and you look ugly to yourself. Don't believe it. It's an exaggeration. It's a distortion. It's shocking to hear this. And that's why we have to see our minds and start. And this is the key job of being a Buddhist. Distinguish between the facts and the fictions. Virtues are valid states of mind and non-virtues are nonsense states of mind. This is the key job from here to Buddhahood. This is why you have to study the Buddhist model of the mind. This is not the way we think in modern psychology. This is not the view in neuroscience. So here we've got the two truths. The two truths, conventional and ultimate. This is how they talk. Conventional and ultimate. The term, the shorthand for conventional is dependent arising, interdependence, that things come into existence or things exist in dependence upon various factors. First, causes. Second, parts. Third, the mind calling it that. That's the subtlest one. And that, and then we have ultimate, the ultimate truth, the final one, which is that is the shorthand, is emptiness. So we're going to unpack these concepts and then bring these two together. Right now we have the two extreme views. When we hear emptiness, we instantly chuck the baby out with the bathwater and think, oh, well, there's no me. I might as well die. You know, there's no this, there's no that. Therefore, nothing matters. That's nihilism. It's the worst mistake. You're falling into the abyss of the great mistake, as Tsongkhapa says. And that happens naturally. We run to that mistake. And this is the major mistake in the literature over the centuries, this misinterpretation of emptiness, you know. It's a fine point. We've got to look into it carefully because we can't hear it properly. So the relationship of the two truths is crucial to understand. We now see them as separate. We hear there's nothing, and then we hear dependent arising, that there is something that does exist in dependence upon this and that. We over-exaggerate and we grasp and say, oh, thank goodness, there must be something. When we hear emptiness, we under-exaggerate and chuck the baby out with the bathwater. So we're going like drunken sailors between these two extremes the whole time. We've got to bring these together. We've got to reverse the process and bring them together. Because when we begin to understand, even intellectually, when we hear dependent arising, things exist interdependently, that things exist in dependence upon this and that, that things are interdependent, that things are dependent arisings. When we hear that, that should lead us to go, ha ha, that means there is no independent existence. That means they lack an independent existence, because independent is the opposite of dependent, isn't it? They lack an independent existence. Now, the trouble here is why we've got to ask the question, why is Buddha telling us that things lack an independent existence? Things lack inherent existence. Things lack self-existence. Things don't exist from their own side. There are many synonyms. What you've got to ask, why is Buddha telling us this? I mean, it's something we've never heard of. So we ought to ask, why are you telling us? Why are you telling us things lack inherent existence, please? He says, guess what, folks? Because you believe in the depth of your being that things have an independent existence. Who would have thought that? We don't think that. because it's so primordial. The mistake is so absolute, so utter, deep in the bones of our being. So the analogy, I use a simple analogy. You know, let's say, who's there? Kate. Kate's on the top, my top row. So Kate, your example. So let's say Kate is colorblind. And every time she sees, every time black is presented to her, where's my thermos? Or where's my black thermos? So we present the black thermos to Kate's eyes. Because her eyes aren't working, she sees pink, let's say. And let's say she's never realized the mistake. So when someone notices and someone says to her, Kate, it's not pink. She goes, what are you talking about? What do you mean it's not pink? Okay, this is an easy one because she knows it's pink. She thinks it's pink. And someone suddenly says it's not pink. She'll get a shock of her life. Of course it's pink. What are you talking about? Well, this mistake we're making is so subtle we don't even know we make it. Who's ever heard that they clung to their own self as an inherent entity? What a joke, you know? Oh, mummy, I think I'm inherent. No, you never said that, I promise. Mummy didn't know it either because the mistake is so subtle. So basically, Kate's making a mistake. Reality is as a black thermos, but her eyes cause her to see pink. We can even bully her into believing it's black, but it's still difficult for her because she sees pink and it appears pink to her and she believes it's pink and she expects it to be pink. So we're living like this all our lives and we've got layers of these mistakes. Ignorance is the root mistake that actually over-exaggerates, that distorts the very, as I said, the ontological status of the thing itself in its bones. Then the branch delusions, attachment, cause it to appear more delicious than it is. Then aversion in the mind, like say, when you're in love with your boyfriend, attachment makes him look divine and he chucks you out for a younger version. And now your aversion kicks in and makes him look ugly. Same bloke. In 1 minute, he turns from beautiful to ugly. I mean, this is not possible, is it? It shows us our stupid mind, you know. All the time, these delusions are making up stories. It's their key function. Jealousy, you know, based in anger, curiously. Angry that how dare that person be happy at my expense, you know. Pride, over-exaggerating your good qualities. Low self-esteem, over-exaggerating your bad qualities. That's what they do. They're not accurate. This is a curious thing because when we think of depression and anger, we don't think of them being accurate or not accurate. We just think of them as being feelings, you know. That's the gross level. So here we're attacking the deepest delusion, which, like I said, is so subtle, we don't even notice we've got it. It's just even hard as we hear it. What do you mean I think I'm inherent? What do you mean I think I'm intrinsic? We can't even get the meaning, you know? So we have to understand the meaning. So the relationship of the two truths is utter and complete because one tells us the other. One leads to the other. As Lama Yeshe paraphrasing Tsongkhapa, paraphrasing Buddha, dependent arising is the king of logics to prove emptiness, whereas we see them as opposite. We hear emptiness, oh, there's nothing. We hear dependent arising, oh, there's something. And these are the two philosophical views of the universe, nihilism, nihilism, and the one of internalism. And that's the teaching of Christianity, of Islam, the soul, something inherent and intrinsic. It's uncaused, partless, all that kind of thing. These are deep in our bones. They're assumptions, the level of assumption, you know. So this is the point across the board. This is so curious to us. Buddha's whole point is that there is suffering in the universe, in your mind. And the key reason why we suffer is because we've got these misconceptions in our mind. So in other words, we're living this disconnect between what exists and how we see things. There's a disconnect between what exists and how we see things. This is what I mean by dualistic, you know. And the final dualism, which is conquered by realizing emptiness, is the sense of a separate me. This sounds so abstract to us. To think that you're not a separate me is hilarious. Or of course we think we're separate me's. So we have to, so dependent arising is the king of logics to prove emptiness. So the word emptiness is very, confuses us enormously because we hear it as nothingness. But it doesn't mean that at all. That's the key thing. So let's look at it. Let's look at the meaning of this word. And the pink example is a good one. Kate's one, a simple one, simple analogy. Or even more simple, I go to drink my tea. I go, oh, my cup's empty. It's the most common thing we'll say, my cup's empty. You're trying to find all the people. You've been invited to a party and you're going in the hotel and you're looking in room to room, you know, for the banquets or something. Oh, no, the room's empty, you'll say. You know perfectly what it means, of people. My cup's empty, of tea. You're looking in your bank for some money. You're expecting there's $5,000, £5,000. You thought there was £22. Oh, my bank account's empty. What is it empty of? Of £22. What is the room empty of? People. What is my cup empty of? Tea. Well, for Kate, so these are emptinesses that are not pleasant. They're not pleasant emptinesses. Something you wanted to be there and you thought was there, you discovered wasn't. So a better example for emptiness of inherent existence is emptiness of cancer. Let's say you go to the doctor, Kate goes to the doctor, and she's got a husband, she's got a kid, she's in the peak of her life. She's believing instinctively everything's permanent. She's got a whole life to look forward to. She's looking forward to her retirement. She's looking forward to going around the world with her husband when the kids grow up and have babies. We plan our lives like this. I'm not being rude. It's okay to have a plan, not a problem. But like everybody, she grasped that as permanent. And then suddenly she's told she's got cancer. She'll be dead in 6 months and she's 42 or something, you know. Panic attack. I mean, complete despair, freaking out. Everything, your life crumbles in front of you. Isn't it? Horror. Because, you know, you believe now. You believe you've got cancer. And then she goes back to the doctor. Sorry, darling, we made a mistake. I showed the wrong x-rays. You haven't got cancer. Now, what would be the thing that she realizes? What would hit her mind like a bomb when she hears you have no cancer? She just realized the absence of cancer. She just realized, oh, I've got no cancer. She's expecting cancer. She believes in the presence of cancer, but this is a delicious one. I mean, I want my tea. I want my 5,000, my 43 pounds, my 22 pounds. I want there to be people. That's a disappointing emptiness. This is a great emptiness. She'll be blissed out. She can't believe there is no cancer after all. So that's the thing that she cognizes, the absence of cancer. I just cognize the absence of tea. Kate cognized on the black thermos, the apogee, when her eyes are fixed, she discovers the absence of pink. When you look in the bank and you discover the absence of 22 pounds, they're absences that are not good, but the absence of cancer is a blissful one. She'll be blissed out. The thing she thought was there, cancer, doesn't exist there. So emptiness refers to the absence of something, not just nothingness. That's the difference. There's a big difference. There's a massive difference. So Kate asks me to look in her bank account. I will tell her the truth. I will simply see the £0. I have no expectations. I'll tell her the truth. There are none. She, though, when she looks at the bank account, she won't notice. She will see the zero, but instantly what will arise in her mind is this shock. Where's my 22 pounds, you'll say. So what she cognizes is the absence of 22 pounds. What I cognize is merely no pounds. They're two separate phenomena. They're two different objects that the mind sees. The mind always cognizes something. So in her case, she cognizes a phenomenon called the absence of 22 pounds. When I pick up my cup, I will cognize the absence of tea. When she looks at the black thermos, we fix her eyes. When we fix her eyes and we'll show her the black thermos again, she'll get the shock of her life. Oh, it's not pink, she'll say. Oh, where's my 22 pounds? Oh, where's my tea? These are simple absences because tea could exist. Pink could exist. 22 pounds could exist. People could exist. These are simple examples. So the absence of something is what only arises in the mind of the person who expects something different. I had no expectations of anything in the bank. I told her the truth. It might have been 5p. It doesn't matter what it is. I will tell her the truth. She will see what she expected to be there, the absence of the precious 22 pounds. When we fix her eyes and we'll show her the black thermos, we think, well, now she'll see the truth. No, not yet. She'll see the absence of pink. That's the name of the phenomenon her mind cognizes. The mind always cognizes nouns. So I say it that way. The mind always cognizes nouns. The presence of something or the absence of something. Absence of something is more abstract, isn't it? So What's Buddha telling us? He's saying we believe in a certain kind of me in here. We believe in an inherent me, in an independent me, in an intrinsic me. Like I said, we don't know what that means yet, but that's the me we believe is there. We believe it's there. That's what we have to prove, how it's not. So the point is, finally, when you've got single point of concentration, you've been practicing for ages and ages, if not lifetimes, and one day the penny will drop and you will see the truth for the first time. Directly. And what you see is that the absence of that fantasy I, and you'll realize there never has been, there isn't, and in fact there never could be that kind of I. So this, these absences I'm talking about, like tea, that could exist. Pink could exist. 22 pounds could exist. People could exist. Cancer could exist. They're just relative, simple examples. But this one is a more dramatic absence, because the thing that we think is there is a complete fabrication, could never exist. So seeing that it has never, it's not as if, as His Holiness says, you look, you know, we'll do the analysis in a minute. You're looking inside here for this I we think is there. You've got to check, you've got to search. It's not as if you chuck everything out looking for the I and then you don't find an I and go, oh, well, there's no I. No, that's nihilism. You do look for the I. And you won't find the I, an independent one. But that's not the real premise, His Holiness says. Things aren't, the I is not empty of inherent existence because you can't find it. You won't find it. But no, not the real premise. It is, the I is empty of inherent existence because you're dependent arising. So we'll go into this. We'll discuss this. So this seeing for the first time that there never has been, isn't, and never could be that kind of I, the independent I, the inherent I, the intrinsic I, the I in and of itself, the I from its own side. Or Lama Yeshe puts it, the I from itself. We don't, that's our problem. We are puzzled by these words only because we don't know what it means, an inherent existent I, which is what we cling to. As I said, the mistake is so subtle. So we've got to first establish what that would mean. Then we can begin to put our thoughts together. We can hear the word pink. We can hear the word to be 22 pounds. They're easy because they can exist. They're not a problem. But this one, we don't even know what it means, an inherent I. That's why we're confused. So we've got to first establish what it means. What would an inherent I be if it did exist? What would an independent I be if it did exist? This is the analysis we have to do. Then we can begin to understand how it doesn't exist. So there's a lot of unpacking we have to do. So when you meditate on emptiness, we think, I've got to meditate on emptiness, you know, oh, the eye is empty, there's no eye, the eye is empty, there's no inherent eye, there's no inherent eye, hoping for the penny to drop. No. You preoccupy your mind with dependent arising. And that is what triggers the insight. Aha, therefore, there is no I from its own side. Emptiness is the conclusion from the thinking about, in this case, the king of logic's dependent arising. So the word emptiness is referring to the lack or the absence within you of an intrinsic you. In other words, you know, I say my cup is empty. Turn it around, and what is it that my mind is cognizing? My mind is cognizing the absence of tea. If, you know, the 22 pounds, what Kate just cognized when she looked in the bank was the absence of 22 pounds. When I looked in the room expecting people, what I cognized was the absence of people. We say the room is empty, but turn it around and make it a noun phrase. That's what the mind cognizes. The mind cognizes nouns, the absence of something. Or equally, you could argue the presence of something. You could argue, when I see people in the room, I'm cognizing the presence of people. When I look in my cup, I'm cognizing the presence of tea. You could argue like that. So the absence of something. So the point is, they're both nouns. They're both phenomena. It's a phenomenon. The absence of something is a phenomenon that the mind can cognize. It's very simple. Kate looks in her bank and she can cognize, because she knows numbers, when she observes the zero, the thing that she will cognize is the absence of her precious £22. That's a cognizable phenomenon. The absence of something is a cognizable phenomenon. It's not just meaning nothingness. It doesn't mean nothingness. That's nihilism. There can't be such a thing as nothingness. It's absurd. It's the absence of something that you thought was there. So in general, this is a really interesting point, a good point. The only person who will recognize the absence of £22 in the bank is the person who expects £22. The only, I mean, you don't, you know, the only person who sees the, who recognizes, cognizes the absence of tea in my cup is the person who expects tea. You don't go into the china shop and buy your cups and saucers and then you say to mummy, oh, mummy, all the cups are empty. No one expects tea in the shop, for God's sake. So it's a really crucial thing to understand. I mean, I don't have cancer, but I don't notice the absence of cancer because I've never thought I had cancer. Kate will get the shock of her life and be blissed out when she discovers that she no longer has cancer. So she's cognizing a very vivid phenomenon called the absence of cancer. The only person who recognizes the absence of cancer in a body is the person who thought cancer was there. You know, so I've been living with Yuval for 27 years. He's been my husband, and I come home and there's a note. I've left you for Kate. Well, believe me, for the next 27 years, if not till the day I die, what will I notice every time I go home? I will notice vividly the really vivid phenomenon called the absence of Yuval. Won't I? Won't I? Won't I? I'll always be recognizing the absence of Yuval. But if you've never heard of Yuval and you visit me, you'll never notice a thing called the absence of Yuval as long as time exists. It's obvious. So we all make this mistake. This is the criterion. This is the kind of the, this is the thing that determines that we're samsaric beings, the believing in an intrinsic me. So we have to discover what Buddha has said is true, which he has discovered, which he says the discovery of this is what cuts samsara and creates and finally causes you to be completely liberated from all suffering, is that there isn't and has never been and can't ever be that kind of I. So in this sense, it's a much more dramatic absence. And as Lama Zopa says, the greatest yogis, the great yogis experience incredible fear when they first discover this. But the greatest yogis have complete joy when they discover the truth. And that second of your first non-conceptual direct insight into this reality, which has to be in single point of concentration, with the subtle mind. That's the first second. You've cut the root. You can't fall back in samsara after that. You can only go forward. You're beginning to climb out of your samsara into your nirvana. You've got more work to do, but you can't fall back after that. You can even lose bodhicitta to a certain degree, but you can't, once you've realized emptiness, you've cut the root of all suffering and all delusions and all nonsense. Now you just got to perfect the realization. You can never lose that. So let's do a little analysis and start searching for this I that we think is there, this independent I. There's different levels of independence. The grossest level we've learned is karma, cause and effect. The first example of dependent arising, and these are arguments that Buddha has had with the prevailing views at the time. So the grossest level of dependent arising he describes, there are hundreds of ways in which things are dependent arising. You know, short exists in dependence upon long. Up exists in dependence upon down. There's millions of those examples, but these are more related. These are more specific ones. So there's the first one is that everything, all impermanent phenomena exist in dependence upon causes. This is already huge. And by thinking about karma, about this I is a product of my causes, not someone else. This is really already a marvelous first step, loosening the grip of ego grasping. You know? The next one, which we'll go into here, this is the one that you look into the lam rim, you're going to see the four-point analysis. So Buddha's telling us that basically he's found that there is no inherent I. There's no intrinsic I. There's no I from its own side. There's no self-existent I. There's no independent I. All these are synonyms. In the Prasangika Madhyamika view, there's many viewpoints that you study when you study Buddhist tenets. There's many viewpoints that Buddha has presented. And you study this text and all the different schools, hundreds of different schools of thought. First of all, from India, you know, for example, you've got the Hinayana views and the Mahayana views. Within the Hinayana, you've got the Vaibhashika and the Satrantika. Then you've got 18 subschools of these and those and blah, blah, blah. And the one that's available, the one that's around these days, the Theravadin, is the only remaining of these 18 subschools of whichever one it is. I forget, the Satrantika or something. There are many different variations. They've listed them all. It's sort of like you read a book about every single variation of all the Christian views in the world. It must be hundreds, isn't it? Thousands, if not thousands. This is what this is. And since, of course, that's India. But since then, Tibetans have probably many different viewpoints already, and the Kagyupas and the Nyingmapas, they all have their own arguments. There's many different interpretations of emptiness, and that's perfectly fine. Nothing wrong with that. It's healthy to have debate. So the view we're discussing here, I mean, I studied all the Buddhist tenets years ago, but I've forgotten all the other views, basically. But I mean, I can't articulate them properly, I'm sorry. But this one is the one the one that is said to be the actual meaning. Buddha's actual meaning, Buddha's intent. And it's known as the consequentialist middle way view. Prasangika Madhyamaka, something like that, these Sanskrit words. It's a very specific view. So in this view, all these terms are synonyms. In the different other schools of thought, they've all got different interpretations. This is much easier in a sense. So independent existence, inherent existence, existing from its own side, existing in and of itself, existing, you know, inherent, I mean, there's about dozens, there's half a dozen more synonyms. Independent for me is the one that sounds most delicious. Independent is the one. So what's Buddha saying? That there is no I. These four, in the sutra teaching, you look at the, in the Lam Rim, you'll see Pabonka Rinpoche, there's a four-point analysis we need to do. Buddha's telling us he has discovered from his own direct experience this reality. And he's discovered, and that's where he diverged from the Hindus. They already had lessened so much of the suffering, the grosser suffering, the suffering of change, and they got to the formless realm and the subtlest level, thinking that's samadhi, but the Buddha would say, no, they've still got the pervasive suffering. They haven't cut the root. They haven't realized emptiness. They're pretty close. They're pretty remarkable. These amazing thinkers back then. So he diverged in his own direction, and so he presents his three levels of dependent arising, arguing with those views. The first one is cause and effect. That's arguing with the fact that there's a soul, an Atman, a self that isn't cause, that's unitary and unchanging or something or other, you know. So then you've got the second one. This is this delicious one. The parts, the things exist, the I and everything else exists in dependence upon its bits and pieces, that you won't find an I among those bits and pieces. Because the coming together of those bits and pieces is the basis of the name I. That's the subtlest one. We'll get to that. So we have to do this analysis. Buddha says, he tells us there's no inherent I. It's not enough just to believe him. It's not enough for us just to tell Kate it's not pink. Her eyes are telling her it's pink. She's got to fix her eyes. She can't just believe in it. It's not helpful. She's got to see the truth. So we've got to fix her eyes in this case, which is easy. Here we've got to fix our mind. So Buddha's basically saying the second one, sorry guys, but because of your ignorance, because of your maripa, this ignorance, known colloquial as ego grasping when the object is I, totally believes either of two mistakes. One, that there is a separate piece in here, as my friend Pende says, walking hand in hand with all the other pieces, called I. Or we think all of me is I, all the bits are I. So we've got to, these are the two things we have to establish, that this is how things, so then we have to argue with these and prove them to be wrong. This is what we have to do, this analysis, you know. To use conceptuality, clear, precise thinking at a subtle level to deconstruct the lie, which will then trigger the insight, aha, there is no independent I. That's emptiness. So the example, let's do the second one. Okay, the word ignorance is already very fascinating. It's really important to understand. It's a simple word, ignorance. You know, and the normal level of ignorance we know is simply meaning you don't know. So, you know, you say to me, what's that? And I'll say, I don't know. Well, it's easy. You just tell me the truth. It's called a thermos. It keeps your tea warm. Thank you very much. Now I know. There's no argument. There's no drama. But the trouble is with the ignorance we have got, not only do we merely not know the reality that there is no independent I, that we not only do we not know the reality that there's no independent I, we think the exact opposite. That's what Kate's doing. Not only does she not know it's black, she believes it's pink. So the ordinary ignorance, she merely doesn't know it's not black. That's not the problem. You can fix that in a minute. But she believes a lie, and then she's imposed the lie on top, and she clings to it. That's how we all do. That's why the pain of samsara. We believe in the lies our mind tell us. Not only do we not know the truth that there's no independent I, we believe the exact opposite, that there is an independent I. This is the tragedy. And then we've clung to this for eons, and it's like ripping off our skin to get to see how it isn't true, because we believe in it. Everything in samsara, all our suffering, all our happiness, all the realms of existence are all the result of this fundamental lie. We've made the universe on the basis of this I, of the belief in this lie. So we have to do the analysis of searching, which sounds so hilarious, searching among the parts that make up me to find the piece that we think is there, the special little part that's called me. Our words express this. What's the main thought in our head? The main player in our head is the word I. We believe there is, and we see a valid cognition of any kind, a valid cognition is a thought that is in sync with the object it's referring to. So I simply say, I have a thermos. You've got to look for a thing that's called a thermos. I'm holding a thermos in my right hand. You can establish pretty quickly that's true, because we know the definition of a thermos. We look at it. We see the shape and color. We know it's labeled thermos. So there is the thought, thermos, and then there's a thing that it refers to. That's a valid cognition. 1 + 1 = 2. We've created that, but we agree that that's true. So I say 1 + 1 = 2. Then I'll put two oranges together. 1 + 1 = 2 oranges. We can prove it. It's a valid cognition. The cognition is in the mind, and the thing it refers to in this case is something out there. That's easy. So when we say I, when we say I have an ear, without analysis, that's a truth. Look, you can see it. There it is. So the thought ear is a valid cognition, because you can point to the object. There's an ear. We agree that's an ear. So that's a valid cognition. Now we've got the other word, I. What does that refer to? Where's the referent object? Where's the object, the existent object that is referred to by that word I? That's where it gets tricky. And Buddha says you start researching, you won't find it. So if you don't know what an ear is, you know, you've got a whole bunch of parts that say, well, you'll give me a clue. Well, it's one of the things on your head, Rabina. I know what a head is. Then I can narrow it down. I can work it out. Where is the ear? That's no, that's lip, that's nose, that's it, that's eye, that's eyelash, that's forehead, that's hair. Finally, we'll deduce, oh, there's the ear. You'll still find it. You will find an ear, definitely, within the head, within the person. So we think also you'll find the eye. You'll find the eye, and we believe it. Look at the feeling behind the word eye. It runs everything. So we believe there is a piece in there called eye. It's very simple. Like there's a piece called ear, a piece called nose, a piece called toe. As Pende says, my friend, working hand in hand with all the other bits. But we give it an extra special status. It's the boss. It runs the show. It makes decisions. And without which nothing would function. That's how we think of the I. And it's a very painful thought. We treasure it. We're insulted, you know, hurt when someone upsets the I. We all know this, but we don't. So we take it for granted. But it says, sorry, mates, you'll find an ear, you'll find a nose, you'll find an eyelash, but you won't find an eye. I'm sorry. You're exaggerating it. It's a shock to us. It's absurd. What are you talking about? So we have to prove it. So I like the idea of going to IKEA. You look up on IKEA on the computer, there's a lovely picture called Rabina. You've got to buy a Rabina. Or you put your own word in there, okay, your own name. It's a really good example. I like this. So you go to IKEA, and initially you're quite disappointed because you don't see a fully developed Rabina. You see a bunch of bloody bits, don't you? I've got to make my own Rabina. What a drag. But it's very helpful. This is a really brilliant discussion of dependent arising. And this is the thing. Dependent arising is being very precise about the bits and pieces. You've got to be very precise. And we get this. So you have to, you know, you have to make, if you have to, you know, even just build a little baby building, a little baby house, you have got to be incredibly precise. When you finally, you know, going to IKEA, you know, apparently I read recently in America that, you know, before internet came along, back in the 20s or before the 20s, what was that company, Sears Roebuck or something? They had catalogs. They went to 2/3 or 4/5 of all homes in America. This catalog, and you could buy, like, even better than Mr. Amazon, you could buy anything. Even they started buying houses that came in boxes, like IKEA, you know, back in the 20s. All you can, all these different shapes. I mean, brilliant. It's so amazing. So you go to IKEA, and you've got to be, and you know yourself, you buy just simply a table. Forget about building a building. You're going to buy a table. You know perfectly well that I was chucking 5 legs and 3 tops and 4 screws, and you hope for your best. You know they are being so precise. Each piece in there has a role, and you put each piece together and you'll get your perfect table. We get that. So let's build a Rabina. Let's build a me. So the millions of bits, I mean, there must be millions of bits. First of all, you've got the bits of your body. Then you've got the bits of your mind, your anger, your love, your kindness, your generosity, your compassion, your subtle mind, your gross mind, millions of bits of your mind, millions of bits of your body. And you're slowly constructing this me. Each piece will have a role. You won't get 2 little fingers. Well, you might, you never know, but normal, you know, typical normal body has 1 little finger on each hand. Get my point now? Now what's happening is we're starting to get nervous because we keep looking among these thousands of parts for a very special part with a special gold envelope with a big little flashy eye written on it. Think about this. And we can't find it. We're panicking because it's not going to be a real me until you find that special piece called I. We believe that totally. The Christians call it a soul. The Hindus call it an Atman. The Greeks call it an essence. In the West, we think it's just called ego or something. I don't know quite, well, we haven't really been very articulate about it. And Buddha says, don't be silly. You don't need something like that. Because this is the point. You don't need something like that to be the boss, because all the parts do beautifully. Look at the table. It's the same thing. We believe in an intrinsic table as well. We believe there's some tableness there, like a special table, like I, that without which there won't be a table. But excuse me, look at a table. There's 1 top, 4 legs, and there are a few screws. That's it. You don't need a special extra little tableness. You don't need it. The table does fine. Same with Rabina. You don't need a special piece called I. You just don't need one. You won't find one, but you don't need one, Buddha says, because all the parts will do beautifully, working together harmoniously to do what? To be Rabina. So what's Rabina actually? This is the third one. It's the name, merely the label we impute upon those parts. So we exaggerate its status. We exaggerate its status. Now, this is the interesting point. Excuse me. If I say I have a nose and an ear. Now, if I say I have a mala, this is a really good example now, of a typical simple example of three. They say there's one argument you have to do in the philosophy that's called if things exist, you're going to have one thing or more than one. So here's an example. I have a mala and a thermos. Have a look. You look with your eyes, and if you're going to see if this is a valid cognition, you're going to see. You have to see 3 separate, independent phenomena, and you can do it. One is called thermos, one is called Rabina, and one is called mala. That's as easy if that's a valid cognition. Within the group of 3, you're going to have 3 things. Within this group, you have a thing labeled a mala, you have a thing labeled Rabina, and you have a thing labeled a thermos. Easy. You've just proven the truth. If I said I have a thermos and an elephant, you'll feel very sorry for me. So that's easy. They're both independent of each other, meaning they don't depend upon each other for their existence. I could drop dead. The thermos and the mala will be fine. The mala will break. The thermos and Rabina are fine. In the simple sense, they don't depend upon each other for their existence. And they also are separate. Now, this is a slightly more nuanced one, but this is the point now. This is more slightly more nuanced. I have a nose and an ear. Well, that's three nouns. Think about this. There's three nouns there. There's three nouns, three. I, okay, pronoun, ear and nose. So we can point to the ear, easy. We can point to the nose, easy. Now the problematic one is the eye. We just assume there's a piece in here somewhere that's called eye. So we have, that's where we have to do the searching. And this is the point. If there were an eye that is separate and independent, which this ignorance thinks, then when you say, when Kate says to me, oh, Rabina, I can't stand your nose. And I'll say, how dare you insult me? And she'll say, no, Rabina, I didn't insult you. I insulted your nose. So if there were a phenomenon in here that bears the label I, when the nose gets insulted, the ear doesn't mind, does it? The ear will be, oh, kind of, oh, phew, I'm glad I'm okay. And my ear can still function. Then when the nose is cut off or is bumped or hurt, the ear's fine. And it's looking on with pity. Poor nose, it's got hurt. I'm okay. Well, so will the eye. If it's independent and separate, the eye will go, phew, I'm glad I haven't been insulted. But this is like a joke for us because we so assume the presence of this special little piece called I that feels somewhere here. And this is the unpacking we have to do. This is the pain and the suffering we experience. We never think of I in terms of blissful and joyful and radiant and loving and perfect. There's very little feeling of I when you have virtues. The feeling of I is looming large when it's delusions. It's always self-pity. This tragic feeling of poor me. Think about it. It sounds very cruel, but this is how it is. We have made it up. We have invented it. But there is an I. This doesn't mean there's no I. It means there's no independent I. This is where it gets more tricky, more nuanced, more subtle. But you can't point to it. And this is leading to the subtlest one, that I is merely labeled. It's not very satisfying for us initially. It feels disappointing, you know. It's a dependent rising I. But you can't point it out. It's not separate. So there is an I, but you can't separate it from the parts. But it's different, as Helen Rissi puts it. It's not the same as the parts. The I cannot be the parts. This is the other argument. The I cannot be the parts, but you can't separate them. There is an I, but not separate from the parts. It's different, but not separate. I is not the parts, but you can't separate them. It's more nuanced than the other one. Ian knows they're simple, you know. What to think about these things? Gosh, it's time to go home already. I can't believe it. I haven't stopped talking. Quick, ask me some questions. I forgot about questions from yesterday, whatever. I'm so sorry, I forgot completely. Ask me some questions from yesterday, whatever.
I'm just going to go back to people who had their hands raised yesterday. Yeah. Sarah, you had your hands raised yesterday.
Venerable Barbara, yes, please.
Sarah, you've got your hand up. Would you like to unmute and ask a question?
Yeah. Yes, sweetheart.
Yes. Hello, Venerable Regina. So, yes, going back to yesterday and previous days, you were talking about the process of being with your loved one when they were...
Being what?
Being with your loved one.
Okay, good. Yes.
So I'm thinking of actually a current situation where my aunt's very near to death, but I'm not able to see her or visit because of lockdown.
That's right, exactly.
So, yes, So what I'm wanting to know, and you did touch on it, is about what I can do practice-wise to kind of help her, because she's obviously, she's not, I'm not going to be around her.
No, darling. Are you close to her for a start? Are you close to her?
Very close.
Can you speak on the telephone to her? Surely you can do that.
Well, I actually did, for the first time since she's been ill, see her yesterday on video, but she's, yeah, it's really hard. She's not really...
Why, darling? She's not conscious?
She's conscious, but it's it was quite hard to communicate, to be fair. She wasn't really hearing very... It was hard to communicate, basically. It just became a hard thing to do. I mean, since we've done this course, I actually wrote a letter. So...
That's good.
With view of things you had said. So yeah. Hopefully, well, yeah, my cousin will read it to her.
Your cousin, that's her child?
Yes.
She can go to see them. She can go in there.
So my cousin's, he's a man, actually, sorry. But no, so she's basically come out of the hospital and she's come home, which is great.
Oh, okay.
Darling,
listen. I'm trying to get some things. So, can you visit her now that she's at home?
No.
Because no one will let you, or because the law says you can't, or what? What reason?
Well, I think it is. But I mean, the law says you can't. But also, I think the family are obviously being very careful about COVID.
So
basically,
the family get along with you. Are you close to your? I have to ask you some questions, Sarah.
Sorry.
Are you close to your family? These people.
Yep.
Can you talk on the phone to her? Forget the video. Can you talk on the phone to her? Have the phone to her ear. Can you talk to her? I'm just asking you, darling.
Yes, it's possible, but it's not been that possible, if you know what I mean.
I don't know what you mean. Why isn't it possible to talk on the phone to her? Have you asked?
Yes. I mean, obviously
no.
I asked to, if there was the possibility of having a call. I mean, obviously, I got that opportunity yesterday, but I guess what I'm saying is they're kind of the immediate family that are kind of calling
the shots.
What
you're saying is they're not letting you do too much. So this is what I'm trying to establish. So if you can't do that, then you don't have a choice but to do other practices.
Yes.
This is all I'm trying to establish is this. If you can have contact, you just talk to her, love her, thank her. You can even sing a little mantra, like a sound. She won't know it's a prayer. It's just like a little song, you know? I mean, then you can leave an imprint in her mind. Now, if you can't do this, you get prayers and practices done for her, sweetheart. You know, Koppan Monastery is probably the best if you don't know one yourself. Are you part of a centre or what?
I'm not that familiar with Tibetan practices. I'm more in the Theravada.
That's up to you to decide what to do then. If you have a system where monks and nuns do prayers and practices for the dying, you can do that. But if you'd like to check on Koppan Monastery, our monastery in Kathmandu, they're doing practices and prayers every day. So you just have to email them, make a little offering, and then they will do prayers. If you'd like to do that, you should talk to Steph or talk to somebody at Land of Joy. And they'll tell you what to do, sweetheart. That's just something you can do, and having people do prayers and invoking the Buddhas can be beneficial for her mind. This is the best you can do, sweetheart.
So then,
yes?
Thank you. Yes. So my next question was just about what I could, I mean, she's of a Christian faith, and I guess, yes, I'm not able to really speak to her. That's basically the answer.
Right, fine, yes.
And obviously, you know, in a regular situation, you would be able to speak to her about God and, you know, the vicar would be around and all that.
That's right, exactly.
So do I, within my own home, as it were, if I do any practices, do I do just things I would do?
Of course you would do things you would do, darling. You don't have to do things she would do.
Practices to do with her religion.
No, sweetheart, you don't have to do that. That's not your business. You do what you do using the tools you know to help her. Let her do her Christian things. Let her family do that part. You do what you can do. You go to the Buddhist monasteries and you do that kind of thing. There's nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with that at all, sweetheart.
Yeah.
Let her do what she wants. If you spoke to her, yes, talk about God. But you don't have to talk about God because you're a Buddhist. You do Buddhist things, sweetheart. There's nothing wrong with that. That's perfect. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah.
Or you feel nervous?
Yes. I mean, I was just kind of clarifying, really, because obviously what I'm saying as well is, like, during this time, and it's, I don't know how long she hasn't got long. I just want to use my mind in the most skillful way.
That's right, darling. Exactly. Yeah, so you feel that you're a Buddhist. You like the Buddhist practices, do you?
Yes, yes.
Okay, then we'll use the Buddha's tool, sweetheart. And I mean, which is what we do in our tradition. We'd go to the monasteries and get anybody. You could have yourself just saying prayers. You could do any prayers you like. You can think of the Buddha. You can make prayers to the Buddha. Whatever you feel you have confidence in that makes sense to you, sweetheart.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Well, thank you.
Yeah. And if you do get a chance to say hello to her, you can just tell her, you know, I love you. You're so kind. You've been so good. You're such a special person. Praise her and say, God loves you. And I'm sure God's, you know, just say things like that for hearing her mind. She might remembering those things.
Yeah.
That
would be just well, so basically, I wrote a card and a letter. So, you know, I'm basically hoping that they will read it to her because it says all those things you've said.
Good, sweetheart. So, yeah. Wonderful. So kind. Fantastic.
Mm. Yeah.
Just perfect. Thank you. Sarah. Good, sweetheart. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much, Sarah.
Venerable Barbara had a question.
Well, I'm going in order, if that's okay, Rabina.
I saw Venerable Barbara's hand go up first.
No, this is from yesterday. Kelly, you had a question from yesterday.
I see.
I've got two in chat as well.
Okay,
Rabina.
Go on then. Please say them.
Kelly, would you like to go ahead?
So when we were talking about not touching the body until the mind has left after.
Right, ideally, yeah, best one, yeah.
I don't know if you can answer this, but obviously, as a doctor, you need to go into that room and confirm what we think is life extinct.
Exactly.
The three kind of components of that you need to do is just confirm that breathing stopped, which is fairly easy to do without touching the body, but you need to feel for a pulse and check pupils.
Sure, that's right.
In the most respectful way that you can.
And exactly.
Not touching anything you don't need to touch.
So the point here, Kelly, it's a very interesting point. I know that the idea, depending on the laws in your country, let's say you die at home, and you know your family know you're, let's say they know you're a Buddhist. I'm not saying you are, I don't know, but let's say you are, and that you want to do all the Tibetan Buddhist approach, then if the law is appropriate, you die. If you don't need to tell anybody for 3 days, you don't tell anybody. You don't need to tell anybody. Then after the 3 days, when you are certain, then you can call the ambulance, then you can call the doctor, then you can, so you don't, even in the hospital, if I'm lying there and I'm sitting in the hospital at 2 a.m. and you stop breathing and I know you're dead, I won't call the other doctors. I'll leave it as long as possible. So then that's the ideal scenario, to leave it as long as possible to then verify what you already know, is that they're dead. You know, so if you have to do it, of course, before that, you do it as gently as possible. That's okay. That's really okay, Kelly. You know, and I mean, if you're a Buddhist doctor, you can always sneak in and whisper a little mantra into their ear. You can always stuck in like that and do that while you're taking their pulse. You understand? Thanks. Yes. Thanks, darling. Go on.
Thanks. Thanks, Kelly. Are you okay to take the next one from the chat?
Yeah, please,
yeah. So this one's come from Ria in India. She's asking, how can one understand form is emptiness and emptiness is form?
Okay, I'll go into that later. We're going to continue with emptiness in the next class.
Okay. All right. I'll leave that one then. The second one.
I'll answer exactly that question. That's the Heart Sutra.
Okay. Just to complete the question, it then goes on to say, and how can it be understood when it's said in the Heart Sutra that there is no attainment and no non-attainment?
Exactly. I'll explain it.
Okay, exactly. Great. Kath, you were next, and then Barbara, if you want to go after Kath, yeah? Kath, do you want to unmute yourself?
I'm here.
Okay,
Hi, Van Ravina. Before you started talking about emptiness, you said 99% of the human race were likely to fall into the lower realms.
The vast majority.
So I've got two questions regarding that. Mm-hmm. One is, well, I mean, I know. Obviously, I'm not holding you to the fact that it's exactly 99%, but the gist of it is that the majority,
the vast majority of humans would go to the lower realms. If you understand, but just let me make the point, though, Catherine, just so we're clear. The reason being, if we understand what creates suffering and what creates happiness, and then we observe most humans who don't know that even their mind plays any role, who have no consciousness and no awareness, and just follow feelings, follow attachment, follow anger, follow jealousy, follow depression, and don't think about impermanence, and die in fear. So there's put all these things together, it's not surprising if that were the case. That's the broader point.
Okay, so two things about that. This is me being ignorant. How does one goes, you know, well, hopefully this one doesn't, and you know, that's me being that's my ego, whatever. But if one, you know, my father or whoever ends up in the lower realms, how is he likely, or, you know, it's not he anymore necessarily, but how is it, you know, how do you come out of the lower realms back into a fresh?
It's difficult. It's possible because we are the proof of it. If all we can do is do the logic, if your mind is beginningless, Kath, if your mind is beginningless, you've had every type of rebirth imaginable. You've been the richest, most sublime, wheel-turning king. You've even, maybe even possible, you've had bodhicitta. You've had incredible realizations. You've been as rich as can be. You've been in the worst realms and the highest realms. Clearly, you're the proof that you can get out of the lower realms because here you are in the human realm. So it's logical because the karmic imprints are there. It's just once you're in the lower realms, it's hard to do anything. It's impossible to do anything to get yourself out. You've got to rely upon that karma running out, and like a miracle at the time of your death, maybe you're someone's little dog, and then because you've got attachment to your human mummy and you die peacefully, and that triggers a human karmic seed and you get a human birth. So it's possible. It's just that it's hard work because you can't do much while you're in the lower realms. But we've all had human births before, so it's not impossible. And that's why we need to help people die well.
Okay, but if I'm just being a bit logical about numbers here, or, you know, maybe I shouldn't be, but if there's 99% of
I didn't say, I mean the vast majority, whatever it might be.
All right, so the vast majority of humans at the moment are going to end up in the lower realms.
That's
so
right.
Where's all the next lot coming from?
Have you not heard of the hell realms, the spirit realms, the animal realms, the god realms, the form realms, the formless realms?
But some of those can come back into the human realm. I'm talking about that's what I mentioned before.
You're the proof of that yourself. So you're human now, right? You're human now. We agree you're human?
Yeah.
Or you're a spirit pretending to be
I've got a couple of secrets to tell you, Ravina, okay. But maybe not now.
You're a human now, but if your mind is beginningless, I just said before, it follows you've been in the other realms. So if you've been in the other realms and you're a human now, it follows logically that so can the other beings become human again.
Okay, fine. Thank you.
That's why we have to help people avoid being born in the lower realms so they can keep on moving on the human path, including the ant, the mouse, the dog, the baby, and your grandpa. This is a powerful job to do. Because all the beings there have got human imprints. They've got human, they've all got Buddha nature, in fact. They've all got the tendency to be able to become a Buddha. It's all there. That's what keeps the bodhisattvas going, never giving up, trying to help, because they know everybody possesses this potential to be Buddha. So this is why the powerful job of helping others is the facilitating of this, and especially at death. This is why it's so precious.
Thank you.
You know what I'm saying? Thank you, Kath. Very helpful. Thank you, darling. We could. How many more questions? We could have a break.